make sure.
Breaking, yeah.
I checked out, so you want to check?
It's good?
Yeah.
Okay. Are there any questions? No. So I want to start by summarizing the main two themes that I've been discussing during all the sessions. One theme is the fact that in quantum mechanics, contrary to classical physics, the basic equation of motions, which are Heisenberg equation of motions, have non-local features in them. And we have shown how in any collision between two particles, there are some features of this collision that can be explained as local interactions, and some other features can be understood only as non-local interactions. And these non-local interactions can be described by exchange of conserved quantities, which are not the momentum and energy, but the modular momentum and the modular energy. And we can understand why these equations of motion in the limit of classical physics become local, because if we look at the quantity cosine p over p zero, this is the one that quantum mechanically has no local equations of motion. P zero is equal to h over l. Then when we go to the classical limit and we go to with h to zero, we either go at the same time with l to zero in order to keep p zero finite. And then in that case, this quantity becomes had only local equations of motion, because the non-locality is due to the fact that we have here a distance L, which is finite. But if H goes to zero, we must go with L to zero also if we want to keep P zero finite. On the other hand, if we want to keep L finite to show the non-locality, and we go with H to zero, then that quantity oscillates infinitely fast and it has no observable minimum. So in this way we see that this dynamical new feature of quantum mechanics that are known locally in nature are really new to the Heisenberg equation of motion, and in the Hamilton equation of motion everything is local. So I was trying to say that if we want to understand what is the deep difference between classical and quantum mechanics, the difference is the fact that the quantum dynamics is described by commutators, and these commutators have truly non-local features, and I've shown to you a number of examples how these non-local features appear, for example, in the AB effect, and also in understanding more deeply interference properties. Now, the other feature, or the other topic that I've discussed, is the fact that because in quantum mechanics we have uncertainties, it's possible in quantum mechanics to have a new situation contrary to classical physics, and that situation is that we can define in time two boundary conditions for a quantum system rather than one. That feature, again, exists only in quantum mechanics, because in classical physics, if we start with definite state for a classical system, and we have given Hamiltonian, there is no freedom anymore to choose another boundary condition, because all the particles will end up in the same state at time t. But in quantum mechanics, we start with an ensemble of particles. All of them are described by the same initial state. We can still do a later experiment and divide this ensemble into sub-ensembles depending on the result of the experiment to the final time, and I call these pre and post selected ensembles. And then the question goes, if we have this pre and post selected ensemble, do we get some new description of quantum systems at the time between the initial time and the final time? And I show to you that we can indeed learn to think about this new situation by saying that each quantum system in the time between T1 and T2, if it has an initial vector in Hilbert space that is described by psi, and we have a final vector in Hilbert space that at the final time is phi, then in the time in between we can say that we have all the right to assume that the system in the time in between is described by two vectors in Hilbert space, one following this direction, the other following this direction. This is psi of t, and this is phi of t. And we have to learn to think about the properties of quantum systems in the time in between by using on equal footing psi and phi. And then the question was, how can we do experiments that will indicate, indeed, that psi and phi live together in this time in between? And I showed that if we look at a new kind of measurement that I call weak measurements, where the interaction of the measuring device with the quantum system is very, very weak, under this condition, that measurement does not disturb any of these vectors. It leaves both of them alive, does not kill any of them. And then the result of this weak value, weak measurement, would be a change in the pointer of the measuring device. If we describe the measurement in the fundamental approach, that we have a pointer and we have a transformation like into the eye, pq for the pointer times a for the system that we want to measure, and then times very weak coupling strength epsilon here. And if this wave function, or this is the probability distribution of the pointer pq, the pointer wave function is described by, say, Gaussian like this in Q, this is the uncertainty in Q, a weak measurement will be a shift of this pointer by a very small delta Q compared to the uncertainty in Q. So if we do such a weak experiment on a single particle, we will not learn anything. So what we do, we come to a single particle, we do this coupling interaction, and we then measure very carefully Q of this measuring device and write it down. Then we repeat this experiment many, many times, all the time on particles that we started with the same state psi, and keep the recording. And then at the end, we look at all this recording and took the sub-recording that happened for those particles that were pre-selected in this way and post-selected in this way. We collect only this sub-ensemble of recording. We then see that we calculate the sum of all the shifts for all this sub-ensemble. Divide by n, we get the shift for each one of them. On the average, we find that the shift was by the weak value. This was the important new lesson. So we can measure a new property of a quantum system that is pre and post selected, provided we have enough replicas, and provided we do very weak coupling. Then we discover that such systems have new kinds of properties, which are named weak values. So weak value is defined mathematically by giving an initial vector and final vector and observable in the time in between. This initial vector and final vector are, the initial vector is sent to the time t where we do this measurement. The final vector is sent backwards from the future to the time t. So the weak value of time t is psi 2 time t a psi 1 divided by psi 2 psi 1. So this is a new property of a quantum system, of any quantum system that has been pre and post selected. So now I want to come back to the fundamental question, how to describe quantum interference without having to use the amplitudes of the wave function, which we don't know physically what they mean. So I want now to really spend some careful time about this fundamental question. So suppose I have an ensemble of particles in one dimension, and this ensemble of particles described initially by two vectors in Hilbert space. This one is a vector in Hilbert space, that is the position representation is described by a Gaussian moving with an average velocity in this direction, and the average velocity is very, very large compared to the uncertainty velocity, so this wave will move for a long time before I have to worry about its spread. So I can write this wave in the Schrödinger representation. The left one as e to the minus x plus l square over 2 delta x square, where delta x is this uncertainty, l is the distance to the center, and it's supposed to be quite far away. So this l is large compared to delta x, and then I multiply it by e to the I k0x, and kh bar k0 is the average momentum, and the average momentum is very large compared to h divided by delta x, so the thing will move for a long time without spreading at all. And then I have the other wave, which is e to the minus x minus l square over 2 delta x square times e to the minus I k 0 x. Because this wave is moving in this direction, it has an average momentum in the opposite direction. And I know what will happen when the two waves meet. When the two waves meet, after a time, which is L divided by the average velocity, they meet together. And then I will see in the Schrödinger representation, the pattern, the wave function will be, when they meet, it will be e to the minus x squared over 2 delta x squared, because the envelope here moved all the way to L, so it will be now wave packet here. And the other one will also be there, and therefore it will be multiplied by e to the I k0x plus e to the minus I k0x, and therefore it will be multiplied by cosine of k0x divided by 2. And that means that if I look now at the probability distribution, I will see something that oscillates the oscillation will be like cosine square of k0x, it's like cosine of 2k0x, right? So this is a very simple example of the famous interference experiment that instead of having two slits, I have now, this is like coming from one slit and this is like coming from the other slit. It's a simple example of the two-slit problem in one dimension. Now, what is the usual statement about this when people look at it from the point of view of the Schrödinger picture? They say the following: if I would have started with an ensemble of particles, all of them moving just from the right, if they're all of them moving just from the right, then of course, if I look at this time, I will see here no interference pattern at all. I will see just e to the minus x squared. If I start with all of them at the left, I see no interference pattern. That means if I close one slit, or I know through which slit each particle went, I don't see interference pattern. So in order to see interference pattern in the middle, I must say that I started with each particle with amplitude at two different locations. And that is the basic reason why we believe that we have to say that a quantum particle at a given time can be in two different locations. Because in this situation, if it were not at two different locations at the same time, we would not have understood what it means to have interference.
Sorry, you're saying in order to get interference, you must start with the particle in two places.
Right, the superposition of this.
This is totally wrong.
What?
It's totally wrong.
What do you mean?
Well, if I put a brick wall and I have a wave, a single wave, mm-hmm. come along and encounter the wall,
yeah.
I get the interference.
No, because you at some time in the middle, you split it into two waves, right? You can't. Here is the picture. If I start with this part, with all the particles just here, and I let them come up to this point, and I make a measurement of position, I will see indeed that there is no interference pattern at all.
If they bounce off a wall.
What?
If they bounce off a wall.
Yeah.
Then there's a right moving and left moving wave, and you get the cosine, and you
may imagine
you also get
the wave going. Like being many wave packets, one behind the other.
Yeah,
and essentially, there is one coming back that interferes with one.
There will be some intermediate
time.
That's
not a very good description.
Yeah, it is, because you can decompose it.
There will be some intermediate time where you have really two waves, right? Because.
Yeah, there's a reflected wave and an incident wave.
Sorry?
There is a reflected wave and an incident wave. But, I don't think they separate very neatly at the wall, around the wall. I mean, here you have two very separate waves.
Suppose I have this wall, and I have a very bold thing, and I look at the time, the intermediate time, where there is half of it moving this way, and half of it moving back, and I remove the wall now. So I want to say, what is this initial state? The initial state here is a wave packet moving with average momentum, large average momentum in this direction, plus a wave packet moving large average momentum in this direction, and the sum of the two giving interference pattern, right? So now I will say, you discuss now, each particle has an amplitude of having large velocity in this direction, and amplitude having a large velocity in this direction.
Yeah.
And I must have both amplitudes.
Yes.
So again, that particle will not be a classical particle because it has to be at the same time, not at two different locations in position, but at two different locations with velocity. It's still a problem, because a classical particle must be either with this velocity or that velocity. Here this particle, because it is having amplitude in one velocity or another, then in position of presentation, it will oscillate, okay? Mm-hmm. So it's not only a question of being at the same time at two different locations. It's being at the same time at two different classical situations, and we don't understand what it means, right? Okay. So now, I come to this problem and I modify it in the following way, to this example, and I modify it or add to it a post-selection. So what I do now, I have an ensemble of particles that all of them started in this linear superposition. And we see for all of them the interference pattern here. Now, when I look at the interference pattern in the middle, I can do two different things. I can either do strong measurement on the position of each one of these particles and get all these interference patterns. That's the usual thing that we consider when we say we have a photographic laser and we see this distribution. That was usually discussed in the 2-3. You have each particle coming from the 2-3. You make a strong experiment to see where it ended on the photographic plate or some other detector. And then you collect all of them and you see the interference pattern. So this is a strong experiment in the middle that measures the properties of this ensemble by destroying it. Now my whole point was that if I have enough replicas, I can find out that interference pattern without at all disturbing any of these particles. The idea of the width measurement was that if I have enough of them, if I interact with each one of them very, very weakly, where I measure the projection operator at each point, so weakly that I don't disturb its space, it stays at all. But if I collect enough of them, I have shown that I can see the same pattern without disturbing any of the particles. If I don't disturb any of the particles, then I can say, let me look at a single particle that started in this. This is now the most important punchline. So I start with a single particle that is in the linear superposition of moving here and moving there, right? I then, on this individual particle at the time, at this time, and come and make very weak measurements of a number of projection operators here, here, and here. I get three numbers that practically mean nothing. The three numbers mean that the measuring device that interacted briefly with the particle at this location, each point it moves by such a small amount, I measure it, but I don't know what it means because it was just a single particle. But I have three numbers. I have a number for this, a number of this, a number of this, for this particle, without disturbing its wave at all, as the limit. So I write these numbers. And then I do the same thing for second particle and third particle, etc. If I collect these numbers without yet doing any post-selection, I collect all of them, I will find the interference pattern. Because that numbers, the sum of them, will give me the average of psi star psi this location. And this is a weak measurement. So I did not disturb any particle. I did not yet use the other information that I could get if I was doing each of these particles a post-selection. So by doing the weak measurement on this interference distribution without disturbing each one of the particles, and because we have enough of them, we can see all the interference patterns by weak measurement, then we can come now and ask an important question. What will happen if after we did this weak measurement, we wait and we see now the particle moving either in this direction or in this direction? Suppose now we come and do a post-selection and ask what will happen if we collect only those answers in the middle for particles that moved in this direction. So this will be now a pre and post selection. The pre-selection will be in particles that are described in this superposition, and the post-selection will tell us that these are particles that all came just from this side. Because we only collected those particles that when we move here, we go back in the past, using our vector from the future, and say, aha, now we collect a sub-ensemble of particles that all of them started here. And they're all moving here. And for some crazy reason, if I look at now at only the distribution of the weak values for position measurement for this sub-ensemble. So for this sub-ensemble, I can say if I measure weakly now the position distribution, I find that there's a wave pattern moving just from here, moving. Suddenly, an interference is produced here, and then it disappears. This is very, very important. So,
sorry,
I want to make sure that you understand it.
I'm not sure what the pre-selection is.
Okay.
Are you only selecting the right, the left moving wave pattern?
No. Okay. Let's do it carefully.
Thank you.
I say, I have an ensemble of particles that at time t1, they were all preselected with superposition of these two wave packets. So all these particles were preselected, the same state of superposition in the Schrödinger representation, superposition of two wave packets, one going this way and the other going this way. All of them are preselected this way. Now, at the intermediate time t, we make on each one of them a very, okay, I will even say more. I want to say something more. As a function of time now, for each one of them, I'm allowed to do weak measurement at any time that I like of the density distribution. Namely, I can choose any time here and come and interact with each individual particle very, very weakly to see what happens if I will measure weakly the projection operator at any place here. That will be measuring the density very weakly without disturbing the particle. Okay? So I have now a picture. If I collect for all the particles, all these measurements, and run it like a movie, I have a computer that for the first one get this number recorded, for the second one got a number. I collect all these numbers and run it like a movie. So if I run it like a movie, ask how does this movie show me the density as a function of time? It will show me that this one is propagating here, this one is propagating there. Then when they meet, suddenly we see interference pattern appearing in this density distribution, and then it disappears, okay? That if I collect all the points of the measurement of the weak measurement of the density, all right? So I have now all the points for all the ensemble.
So you didn't really describe what is the post-selection?
I don't get that. I'm so for post-selection.
But to even discuss weak measurement, you have to define the post-selection.
No, I can say, okay, there are two ways to say. Suppose I post-select on each one of them the same initial state when it comes there. Then you know, I will find always the same one because the probability to change it goes to zero. So if I post-select on the same initial state, propagating in time, the whole idea of weak measurement tells you that we will find this probability 1 minus 1 over n, all of them in the same state, right? So one possible post-selection is that measuring whether the state changed or not. And if you do that, you will find that you get that the weak value will be just the usual average for the ensemble. And because what you got in the middle cannot depend on which measurement you do at the end, if you collect all of them, then you say, I must, if in the middle I measure the distribution for all of them, I will always find the average from the initial thing, because it cannot depend on what measurement I will do at the end. If I do at the end the measurement that one outcome is the same state and the other outcome is orthogonal state, that measurement will give me, for all of them, the same initial state. That means that the weak value, if I collect all of them, must be the average. So I can first tell you, suppose I don't tell you that what post-selection I do. I just tell you I collect all the weak measurements of the density coming from the past without disturbing particles. Then I will see the usual prediction of the interference pattern. But now, when all these results are recorded there, I can now come and this time do a post-selection. Because I didn't disturb any of these particles by this weak measurement, I can now do a post-selection and say, this particle, is it moving now in this direction, or is it moving now in this direction? So if I find that this particle is moving in this direction, I can send this vector back in time, and I say, from the beginning, I know that this particle has two information. One, that it started at this stage, and second, that it was also only here, right? So if I now collect all the results for all the particles that ended up here, about half of them, collect only those results, and look at what the density measurements were, which density measurements were in the middle, I see a very interesting, beautiful picture. So if I look at rho of XLT, the density, based on pre and post selection, then this is equal to psi 2 star of x and t, psi 1 of x and t, and I have to divide by normalization constant, which is irrelevant, to get one the integral. But actual normalization constant is this thing. Instead of having the usual density, which is psi star of x and t times psi of x and t, if I have two vectors, one coming from the past and the other coming from the future, and ask what will happen if I do weak measurement of the distribution here, I will find that the weak value of the density is given by this quantity. The product of the vector coming from the future, this is the weak value. If I look at the weak value, if I look at the weak value of the projection operator, xx, then I have to put here psi 1 of x, and here I take psi 2 of x, psi 1, psi 2, and divide by psi 2, psi 1. This is just a number. This is a normalization. But this is giving me psi 2 of x, psi 2 star of x, times psi of x, when I take the scalar product with the projection operator. So the density that I measure, if I collect all the information of the weak measurement of the density by having both pre and post selection, I have to use this product. So what does this product tell me? If I look at the initial time, the vector psi 1 of x had was this plus this. The vector psi 2 of x was just this one. So therefore, the product will give me a density that's only here. So if I look at the density that I will measure for this cap particle, that I did measure for this cap, remember, I have the density measurement for all of them. Then I correct only those results that were for the cases where I got the final thing moving here and this initial thing. Then I will see a whole distribution of particles like a liquid, all of them moving here only. They move here, all of them with this density, until they come in the middle. When they come in the middle, they suddenly develop interference pattern in their density. Then they move further and let it disappear. It's a fantastic thing. This actually would have happened if I had a real example where pre and post selection like that, and somebody was measuring all the time weakly the density of that liquid. We see with density moving like ordinary normal liquid, suddenly in the middle it appears beautiful interference pattern for no reason at all. And then it disappears, okay? This would be the picture. And then in this picture, if I come at the top of it and say sometime in the middle here, when this particle are moving from the right, I put some potential on the left when there is no particle at all. And lo and behold, in that case, I will see later what the interference pattern is was shifted. Because there was some non-local interaction between the potential that I put here and all the particles that move in there. The question is now, what is the best way to explain this kind of experiment? Is it the Schrödinger picture or is it the Heisenberg picture? In the Schrödinger picture, I have to say, the reason why I see particles moving only here is because actually I have two Schrödinger waves that are around. There is one Schrödinger wave that comes from the past, which tells me that each particle is also here and here. There is another Schrödinger wave that comes back from the future. They tell me that the particles are only here, and I have to use both Schrödinger waves in order to understand why there is still interference pattern. Because the Schrödinger waves that come from the past tell me about the interference pattern, even though that together they know that there are only particles on the right. So in the Schrödinger picture, I have to say something that is very, very non-intuitive, because I have to say for the same particle, it is in the same time in both locations, and at the same time only here. This was what the two vectors tell me. The vector from the past tell me, in order to understand what's happening, you must assume that these particles, each one of them, are in two locations at the same time. And the vector that comes from the future tell me, no, all of them are only here. All of them. So if I look at the pre and post selection, I have two vectors in show you a picture that tells me something that there is no way to understand intuitively. Because we say at the same time, we have to say that each particle must be in both locations at the same time, and each particle must be only here at the same time. These are two contradictory statements if we think about it intuitively. It's not contradictory mathematically. You can have a wave here, a wave there. Why can't I say two waves? But when I try to think what it means, I run into a problem. And that's why I think nobody was able to develop real intuition about quantum mechanics because of that contradiction, basically. Now, in the Heisenberg picture, there is something completely different I can say. I can say that when the particles start in this superposition, it means that each one of them has also a quantity that I call modular momentum. Then the modular momentum depends on the fact if they're only here, that modular momentum is completely unknown. If they're in superposition, that modular momentum has a value that depends on the relative phase. And if I now say that the particles, knowing that all the particles are here, if I look at it from the point of view of both boundary conditions, so Heisenberg will say, no problem at all. I have all the particles here, and all these particles also have a non-local property that sits with them at that location. That non-local property is the modular momentum. And that modular momentum is responsible to tell me why at the mirror I saw interference pattern. So we have to see, first of all, how does the modular momentum tell you that? And then to learn to think about the idea that if we have two boundary conditions, one of them tells me where the particle is, and the other of them tells me what is the modular momentum. One boundary condition couldn't do it because the two things don't commute. But with two boundary conditions, I can have the case in easy. The future tells me where the particle is, the past tells me which modular momentum it has, and both of them together explain A, why is there interference pattern in the mirror, and B, why if I do something where there is no particle, it affects the picture. So that's the non-locality. If you learn to think this way, I believe you can develop intuition about quantum mechanics. Well, nobody could believe intuition about somebody that tells you, look, the particle is in both places, and it's also only here. No way to develop physical intuition about this, only mathematics. But here I can develop intuition. I can say, I believe that quantum particles, contrary to classical particles, can be at a given location and have another property which is not velocity, but some function of the velocity, that tells you how this distribution will, what the probability of the position will be later, as I will show you very carefully soon. And that property that sits together with the particle, when the particle gets a location, it has also this property. This property has no local equation of motion, that therefore it's affected by a slit when the particle was not there. And it tells you what the interference pattern is. That you can develop intuition, although you have to unlearn. We have all learned that only local interaction can happen, because otherwise it's inconsistent. That's why Maxwell came and taught us the two particles don't interact locally, they interact by messengers of electromagnetic fields that come locally to the particle what it is. Suddenly now we have to unlearn that and say, there is a new physics that comes back to the Newton time that tells us are also properties that do have non-local interaction, but we save the day with causality because of the uncertainty that changes from violating causality. So, this is in a nutshell the picture I'm trying to develop, and I will first show you how to look at the density of particles and from this deduce the effect of the modulo in dictating what the density will be. That will be clear now from what I'm going to say. So I want now to raise the following question that will help to understand that picture. I have only one dimension and three particles. I want to see how, if I'm only allowed to measure the density as a function of time, And I don't just consider P and post direction, I only consider phase direction. If I consider phase direction, and I discuss it in the Schrodinger picture, I have psi, a wave which is a function of S and T. And I'm telling you, I'm only allowed to measure for this wave at any time the density. The only thing I can measure are the density rho of S and T, which is psi star of S and T times psi of S and T. The question is, if I know the density at a given time, I certainly don't know what psi is, because I don't know anything about the phase, right? And that phase is very important to tell me what will happen later. So the question is, by measuring rho not only at one time, but measuring rho at different time for the ensemble, can I from that find out what was psi? If I would be allowed to measure it only at one time, I couldn't. So the question is now, what information about the initial psi, at time zero I had the initial psi. This was psi at the time zero. At some later time t, that was t, is t equal to zero. At some later time t, I measure for the ensemble psi star of x and t, psi of x and t. I have an ensemble. I don't know what psi of x zero is. I only can calculate the density at time zero, because that's the only thing I can measure at time zero. And then at a later time, I measure for the ensemble the density. So I know psi star of x and t, psi of x and t. What does that tell me if it's a free particle about the distribution initially, about the wave function initially? How much can I learn about the wave function initially if I'm only allowed to make measurements of densities at time t? So the answer is very interesting. If I know psi of x and t, I can calculate psi star of x and t, psi of x and t, multiplied by e to the ikx, integrate over x, and define it to be rho k. Rho k times t. So rho k times t is the Fourier transform of the probability density at time t with k, okay? So now I ask, what does this tell me about psi at time zero? So now I use the Heisenberg picture in the following way. If I calculate, this is a general way, in fact, that I think it was Ehrenfest that developed the connection to dynamics. If I calculate psi of t times time-independent operator times psi of t, I can calculate this in two different ways. This can be written as u times psi of zero, where u is the time evolution operator, times a. This is u of t. Okay, this is u from zero to time t, which is u is equal to e to the minus I h t minus c zero divided by h bar. This is the time evolution operator. So when I calculate psi t a psi, this is, I want to write it as u of t, the time evolution to time t from zero, times psi of zero, times a, times u of t, times psi of zero. And now we can bring the u and the u from here to here as u dagger, and the u from here to here as u. So this is equal, this is equal to psi zero, psi times zero, u dagger of t, a u of t, psi times zero. So I can see that I can calculate the properties of any observable at time t by either using the wave function at time t or instead using the wave function at time zero, but using here the time evolution operator according to the Heisenberg equation of motion. So that means that if I calculate that thing, I can either use this by using the wave function at time t, or instead I can write the integral of psi star of x at time zero, e to the I k, an operator x as a function of t, or this will be the time evolution according to that, time psi of x as zero dx. So I calculate the same thing here, the average of the operator e to the I k is by using the original distribution, but using instead this operator where x of t is u dagger xu according to the free Hamiltonian. And then it's trivial to show then that x of t, the Hamiltonian is p squared over 2m, the free Hamiltonian. Therefore, I know that the x dt is equal to p over m, dp dt is equal to zero. These are both Heisenberg and Hamiltonian equation of motion. For this Hamiltonian, they are the same. And therefore, immediately I can solve for it that x at time t is equal to x at time zero plus p over m times t, right? And therefore, I said that if I measure the density of this part, this ensemble at time t, so I know psi star of x and t for the ensemble, psi of x and t, then I take the Fourier transform of this, and define it to be rho k of t. I can say that rho k of t can give me information about psi times zero because it's equal to the integral of psi star of x times zero e to the I k x plus p over m t times psi of x times zero dx. And t is a given number because we, so this is, now we see that this information gives us the average of modulo variables like operators or exponential operators of combination of x and p. Okay, this is alpha x plus beta p. And if we look for all k's and for all t's, then we find all the information that we need at psi equal to zero just by looking at the distribution at all times. This is the proof of it. Because if I know the average of any e to the I alpha x plus beta p, if I know the average of this for every alpha and beta, then I claim that there is only one unique wave function that can satisfy all these averages. So it's enough to know all these averages in order to know psi. And I can calculate all these averages by knowing psi sub psi at all times. Because if I know psi sub psi at all times, I can calculate these things for arbitrary k and for arbitrary t. If I can calculate both for arbitrary k and arbitrary k and arbitrary t by knowing rho at all times, then I know e to the I alpha x plus beta p for every alpha and beta. So that shows that it's enough just to discuss density of position at all different times to include, calculate from this what was the initial wave function. If I do it not with the density just from pre-selection, but I do it with density of pre and post-selection, then I will in fact find by just measuring of the densities, I will find information about the two vectors that came from the past and came from the future. So after intermission, I will show you how from doing that, I can connect it with the two waves that I started with. The two waves that I started here, the Gaussian moving this way and the Gaussian moving that way, are really the average of some particular operation like this, the operator takes me one from one wave to the other, and at the same time changes the momentum, because the momentum here was different from the momentum there. So the thing that connects the operator, the non-local operator, if I start with the two wave packets, one moving like this and the other moving like that, I ask which non-local operator will take me from this one to that one. So first of all, I have to do a shift by distance 2L to bring this one up to here. This will be e to the IP times 2L. But that's not enough, because when I bring it here, it will still move in this direction. So I have also to connect that momentum to this momentum, so I have also to multiply by e to the I 2 k0 times x to connect the momentum. So if I look at the operator, e to the I p times 2l, okay, I write e to the I p x plus p x l plus, and write 2 here, plus x, p, x k0. So this thing will take me, and divide, if I divide by h bar and multiply by h bar, then this thing will take me by distance 2l from here to here. This thing will take the moment, the, correct the momentum correctly. And in fact, it turns out that this term is exactly the x plus p over mt if I do it the right way. But I want to show it to you after intermission. So after intermission, you will see the connection between saying that the interference pattern is dictated by where the particle is, and at the same time what non-local property it has, which is discussed by this kind of operator. Let's have an intermission.
So
yeah.
Just tell us what the second term is in the exponent. It's x times something.
I say that I want to take the wave packet, I have here a Gaussian e to the minus x plus n squared over 2 delta squared e to the I k 0x.
Yes.
This is this Gaussian. And I have the other Gaussian here, which is e to the minus x plus l, like minus l squared over 2 delta squared times e to the minus I k 0x. This is one wave, and this is another wave. I want to find a non-local operator that will take me this one and bring it to that one. So I first have to shift the position from minus L to plus L here. So I have to write a shift in position, which is equal to the I P X times 2L over H bar. This operator, if I multiply this one, it will bring it to here. But now it's not enough, because if I take this one and bring it to here, I bring it with the same position but with opposite average momentum. So I have to connect the to do also an operator that shifts the momentum. The shift of the momentum is e to the I to I k zero x. The operator e to the I x is a translation operator in momentum space. And I have to translate it by 2 times k0. So the thing that is will be sensitive to this initial thing is this modular variable. This is a combination of px times one value and x times another value. And you have seen how the connection, in general here, how the connection between distribution at one time and another time happened is due to such operators. So we'll see that indeed the operator that appears there is exactly what we need after the intermission. Okay? But before the intermission, I want to repeat again. We have two ways to think about this ensemble of particles that correspond to a two-sit experiment, but in one dimension, this ensemble of particles that move in two wave packets, one coming from here and the one coming from there. That is similar to what happens when you have a two-sit. But instead of having two things in two dimensional higher dimension, I simplify by saying I have wave that comes from here, wave that comes from here, this is one thing, this is the other thing. This one alone will never show interference pattern. This one alone will never show interference pattern. But together, they suddenly give me zeros, a place where It will not happen for this one alone. So then, in the Schrodinger picture, I must have both things, both amplitudes, to explain the zeros in the middle, in the interference pattern when they meet. Not the way to explain it. Not the way, because if I did not have a pattern in both locations, I will never get a zero, because the pattern from here will never produce a zero, the pattern from here will never produce a zero. So to produce a zero in the density, I must have something coming from both sides, and that is the basic idea why we always said that we know that the quantum pattern must be in two different locations at the same time in order to explain the appearance of this zero in the interference pattern. Okay? This is the way that you say it always when you teach quantum mechanics. But now I see that I start with this ensemble and I see all these zeros appearing there, but I do it very carefully. I don't want to destroy the reality of this quantum reality, so I do very weak measurement. Very weak measurements will never tell me that there is zero when there is one particle. But if I do very weak measurements of the densities by coming very weakly to each particle and collecting all the results, then I get the pattern to a very good approximation without disturbing even a single particle. This was the whole idea of weak measurement at the limit when n goes to infinity. So what I do, I keep each particle, I keep measuring very weakly its density, but when I collect all these numbers that I wrote down for the shift of the meters, very small shift, I see the pattern, the interference pattern there without disturbing even a single one. Because I didn't disturb every single one, I can wait still longer and do a strong measurement now to check on each one of them whether it went this way or that way. So we have a strong initial measurement. They can prepare particles to go in both ways. How do I start it? I start with a single particle. I say, we have a wave pressure. They put half reflection mirror. So it's splitting to one part going this way, another part going this way. I put two mirrors. Then I prepare, that's how it prepares the initial state of two wave pressures going this way, but only doing local measurement. Then, this is the first strong experiment. Then I collect by weak measurement for an ensemble of such preparation the result of the density measurement weakly. Then after that I do a strong measurement on each particle to know whether it went to the left or went to the right. And then I can go back and collect only the numbers for the density weak measurement for those that went to the left only. And lo and behold, when I do that, and I write the picture, the computer picture that collects all these measurements, it will show a fantastic picture. It will show a picture because it collected all the density. So it will show a picture of densities that move like this, no pattern here at all. And after some time, for no reason at all, when they arrive at this point, they suddenly produce an interference pattern like this. This is all in the numbers that are there. That are collected, that were collected before. We wait for further time, look at the numbers for the density here, that disappears, and now all of them moving like this with no pattern at all. And the question is now, why did this happen? And we see even something more surprising. If we repeat the same experiment again, but now, when the particles are moving here, after the post-selection, we put here a potential in this region. That potential X only of particles that will be here in the Schrodinger picture. This potential doesn't do anything to this particle. Remember, we only collect this particle. We see now when this pattern now will be shifted, the maximum and minimum, because we put the potential here where there were no particles when we do as the sub-ensemble pre- and post-selected one. How did it affect them? We don't have the Schrodinger picture that says, okay, you have something that comes from the past in both places, that's why it affects it. Because we want to look only at what really the densities are. The densities of the pre- and post-selection are all of them here. They all of them move here, they appear here now with a different pattern because we put a potential that is not there. So I claim that in the Heisenberg picture, we have a beautiful way of understanding it. We say that all the properties moved here has also another property, which is this modular variable. That property translates into this pattern, according to this formula, as I will show you here. They translate into this pattern because this pattern has this modular variable property, and then they disappear again. If I put the potential here, that modular variables have no local equation of motion, it's affected by this. So that's why later the pattern here will be different. This is a picture I'm trying to develop, and we'll discuss it more after intermission. Thank you. Any questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a question. This is the one of the things that now with a double slit, with a two-way function in the light going the way, left going the way.
Yeah.
Is the initial condition.
Right.
Finally, it's just the left going the way.
That's right.
Yeah. Does your explanation looks like the time correlation between is the initial condition and the final condition?
Yeah, what?
It's a time correlation between two.
Time correlation?
Yes.
Yeah, make a local experiment. I'm talking now only about local experiments in time and density. If you look now at the modular energy, then there are other questions that we can ask and we'll discuss it another time. But no, it's a question about not only modular momentum, but also modular energy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but it's a little bit out of what we're discussing now. But yeah, there are interesting questions you can ask about modular energy also. But it's enough new things about just modular momentum.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, so if we look at what happens when we say we have the wave packet moving this way and the wave packet moving this way, this is e to the minus x plus L square over 2 delta square e to the I k 0 x, and this is e to the minus x minus L square times e to the minus I k 0 x. So we say if we wait the right time, which is L over the average velocity, when the two meet, we get the interference pattern or the density pattern, the rho of x and t equals to L over V average. This initial state is that t equals to 0. We look now what happens at t equals to L over V average when they meet. What is the density? The density is essentially e to the minus x squared over 2 over delta squared times cosine k 0 x, maybe divided by square root of 2. Divide by normalization term, anyhow. There is 2k0x. Forget about the normalization term. This is the density up to normalization term. And no, this is the amplitude. The density will be cosine squared. Right? The amplitude is e to the minus x squared over 2 delta squared times e to the I k0x plus e to the minus I k0x, which is cosine k0x up to, so therefore the probability will be this without the 2 here, and cosine squared k0x, right? This is the probability density. And cosine squared of k0x is 1 plus cosine 2k0x divided by 2, right? Because cosine 2k0x is cosine square minus sine square, 1 minus square is cosine square, so this is it. So in the density, we have first of all the trivial one, which is the one that we are not interested in, and then there is the one that oscillates. The one that oscillates is with 2k0x, not k0x, but 2k0x. Therefore, if I want now to look at the integral of 4 of x at time t, e to the I k x dx to find rho of k, I should choose here for k 2k0, because if I choose to take 2k0 here, I will get from this contribution something else, right? So therefore, I know that in OK of t, if I take the integral of x of t e to the 2i k0x dx, and I calculate either with plus 2 or minus 2, I will get that contribution, because in the cosine 2k0x, there is e to the 2i k0x and e to the minus 2i k0x. So I multiply by this, I get just the integral of O itself. So the big contribution for OK is for k equal to either 2k0 or minus 2k0, right? These are the only Fourier components that will give me a finite contribution. So now I want to see what does this tell me about the original distribution. I see that at time t, the average of e to the I 2k0x, this average is large. And also the average of e to the minus 2k0x is large if I calculate it at time t, right? I see some empty eyes here. At time t, the density was e to the minus x squared. This is essentially a constant over the region that we are interested. This is over 2 delta squared. Delta is very large compared to the wavelength we are talking here. And this was the distribution multiplied by cosine 2k0x. This is the distribution. If I want to take Fourier transform of that and see when do I get a large contribution, I can write this as e to the 2k0x and e to the minus 2k0x. If I multiply by e to the 2k0x, multiply the e to the minus 2k0x from here, I get 1. That integral will be large. So the only places where I get large contribution would be either for k equals to 0, that's when I integrate the distribution itself, or that's from the 1, or if I look at k0, at k here, that equals to 2k0x, that's for this row k, when I take k to be 2k0, I get a large contribution. So I want to see what does this mean about the initial state. I saw that the stress at time t, I found that the average of e to the 2i k0x was large. I want to see what does this imply for time zero, for the distribution of time zero. So I'm saying that thing, when I calculate time t, is the same as calculating psi star of x at time zero, e to the 2i k0 times x plus p over mt, because x at time t is the same as x plus p over m t at time zero, times psi of x at time zero, dx. So this thing implies that this thing must be large at time t equals to zero, this average. That's the same statement. So let's see why this average indeed is large from the initial state. So the initial state was e to the minus x plus l squared times e to the I k0x. And then there was the other state, e to the plus x plus e to the minus x minus l squared times e to the minus I k0x. So we want to see if this operator here is the one that takes psi 1 from here and brings it to psi 2 from here. Otherwise, it will be large. So, we want to see whether this translation operator translates one wave into the other wave, because that's exactly how we can get a large contribution. Okay? So, I have e to the 2ik0x, k0, times x plus p over m t. But for C, I know what to do. I have to put here L over V average, over P average. Let me over V average, okay? All right, so now let's see what it is. I'm interested in this term. This term is P over M times L divided by P average over M. Right? So the M cancels, and this is PL, P over P average times L, right? And now I have to multiply it by 2K0. But K0 is the same as H bar K is equal to P, so K is equal to P over H. So I have to multiply it by 2P, average, because K0 is P average, divided by H. So this cancel, and we are left with 2PL divided by H bar. So we see then that this is a translation operator in the momentum space by 2K0. So that repair is the two wave packets. When I want to bring this one to that one, I have to do two things. I have to bring it by distance to L, and I have to change the momentum of this to the momentum of that. This thing changes the momentum of one to the momentum of the other, because it shifts exactly by 2 at K0, so it corrects from minus K0 to plus K0. And now we have shown also that this thing, that part, is exactly a shift operator in position by L. So indeed we have shown, therefore, that the interference pattern can be understood as a property of the average of the modulo variables at time t0. So what is state, what will be the interference pattern later, is a knowledge of what is the modulo variable average is the initial time. That's what we have shown, right? And now we are not surprised that we can affect it by doing something far away, because we know that the equation of motion for this variable is a non-local equation of motion. So I repeat now the story, very, very important, if you understand all the mathematics. First of all, are there any questions about the mathematics? So I will now repeat what the mathematics tells us in words, and see if we can develop intuition about it. So I say, by pre and post selection, I know that if I look at the density of all the particles that were pre and post selected, I see a density that is just on the right, moving with average velocity V0, moving in time. I look just at all the points that are measured weakly, all the density. And look only in those cases that were pre and post selected. Then I see that all these points, if I collect them together, show me like a movie. Something that is moving has a density like this, with constant velocity, until it appears at some mysterious point here. And when it appears at this mysterious point, or begins to appear here, I begin to see some evolution like this in the density. It's slowly appearing. Then it's slowly disappearing. And by the time it goes all the way to here, it disappears completely. And the question is, why do I see something like this? And on top of this, if I repeat this experiment again for a pre and post selection sample, where I put some potential here, I see that where there is no particle at all, I see that that pattern is changing. Okay? So the question is, why? Why the first pattern and why the change? So the first pattern appears, we say, because all the particles that are here have also non-local properties, which are described by the average of this thing. I have the average of the modulo position momentum together, I have the average of this quantity, e to the I, pn plus x, p0, divided by h bar, and I think multiplied by 2. So I have this thing, this, I have this Hermitian operator. If I take this plus this complex conjugate, and the cosine of p of this, plus the sine of this, these are modular variables that I see that I can measure on the ensemble, I can measure their average, and I see that this is the quantity that all these particles have, even though they are in different locations, they have also this property initially. And this property initially changes later in time by the Heisenberg equation of motion, changes thus to the average of the position, and that shows why there will be interference of pattern. And also the property of this quantity times equals zero, that if I put a potential at a distance L away, or 2L away from where the particle is, that will change. So I can change the property by doing something non-locally because of the non-local equation of motion, and therefore I can explain why later, when the interference pattern appears, it already knows that I put a non-local effect earlier. So this is the Heisenberg picture, and I think it's very, very nice. We just have to really develop a new intuition that says that it's okay to have non-locality, provided we are protected by uncertainties, not to violate causality. That issue, I will explain more carefully how the uncertainties protect causality, even though we have this non-locality, we'll discuss tomorrow's session carefully. But today, we can say the following. In the Heisenberg picture, we can have particles that are all localized. We don't need to put particles at the same time at two different locations. We replace the idea of two different locations by the idea that the particle can be at one location and having another property which is sensitive to what we do in the other location. So this part, all these particles now are starting being in this location. They move. They have all the time this non-local property that's slowly changing into a local one as a function of time. So by the time it arrives here, this non-local property, which was pn plus x, becomes just x, so it becomes suddenly a local property, and we see it in the local distribution. Then it becomes non-local again, and it disappears. So we can understand the whole pattern of starting with very simple distribution here. Sometime later, it appears to be a very complicated one. Then it's again, because this particle, all of them that were here, has also this non-local property, that converts itself to a local one in time because of the Heisenberg equation of motion. So h plus p, which is a non-local property, becomes h later because of the time evolution. And when it becomes h later, then the non-local modular variables become local ones, and that's why we see interference pattern. That's the Heisenberg picture. If we want to speak about it in the Schrödinger picture, we run into language that becomes only mathematics, because we can't develop any intuition. I believe we can develop intuition about non-local interaction. I don't believe we can develop intuition about saying at the same time that a particle is in both locations, and at the same time we are sure that it's in this location. We are sure that it's in both locations, we are sure that it's in this location. This is mathematics. There is no physical intuition that we can develop for this. There is a physical intuition that we can develop if we think about non-local equations of motion and the Heisenberg picture. So from this point of view, I say that if we want to start from classical physics and ask how do we go from this to quantum mechanics, what is the basic principle that we have to start with? The basic principle is not that particles are waves, which is the usual way to present it, and uncertainty. The basic new thing is that we replace Poisson bracket by commutator, we replace one dynamic by another consistent dynamic, and that new consistent dynamic, the new feature that it has, is that it has no local property. And these are the properties that explain interference, and not the fact that the particle is described by waves. The wave is not the correct description. Although it gives us very simple, nice mathematics, it's misleading because it speaks about a language that we can understand only mathematically and not physically, because I don't understand what it means for a single particle to be a wave. I can understand what this wave to a probability meaning. I can't understand this to be a spread, a physical spread over all this region, like the electromagnetic wave is a spread, physical spread everywhere. For a single particle to be described by a wave, I have no understanding what it means. I can understand that it means that I have a lack of knowledge where the particle is, but the particle is always at one location. That I can understand. But that's not what the amplitude means. Amplitude means more than just absolute value and probability. So this is a mathematical notion of wave that I can't develop any intuition about it, and I'm not alone. Because Feynman and other people that honestly think about, talk about quantum mechanics, admitted that they know how to use it mathematically to calculate things. But when they try to really understand what this means, they ran into abyss, Feynman said, deep hole. You fall into deep hole, what?
Blind alley. Blind alley.
Yeah, whatever. Okay, so I think that there is a way to replace that language, which is purely mathematical, to a physical language, which is the Heisenberg picture. And this is my message. So if there are no more questions, I want to use the next few minutes for some fun, okay? Fun in physics. You have a question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I understand what you're saying, but there's no way for us to develop physical intuition that the particle be two places at once and yet only in one place.
At the same time.
At the same time, yeah, yeah. Of course. But does that really mean, just because we as human beings can't develop very good physical intuition for it, does that really mean it's not the most accurate picture of what nature might really be doing?
No, it only means if we want to develop intuition about the mathematics, we have to use, first of all, we are interested in understanding or having a good story to tell about the mathematics which is quantum mechanics. We have a consistent mathematics. We have Hilbert space, we have vectors in Hilbert space, we know how to evolve them as a function of time, we can do it in different representations, one of the Schrödinger representation, energy representation. We can do all this mathematically. But then we want to develop a story, an intuitive story that goes beyond the mathematics that we can understand. And I want to find, it's very important to have such a story because this can help us to ask, you're going to miss a very interesting fun. I will tell you later. I will tell you later. Okay.
Yes.
So, if you ask, well, I said that at least for me, I can't tell a story to anyone, to any student, or anyone that asks me what is quantum mechanics, I tell him a story. Oh, quantum mechanics tells that the particle is at the same time in two different places, and at the same time is also in one location. The minute when he hears that as a story, we say, thank you very much, I don't want to listen to you anymore, because it doesn't make sense. What you are telling me doesn't make sense. How can the particle at the same time be completely here and at the same time in two different locations? These are two contradictory terms. Okay? Now I can, doing mathematics, say the particle has two descriptions, one by this way, the other by this way. But this is not intuition. The intuition is supposed to tell us.
But the problem is that your story is really difficult. It's only good for your story is really difficult. It's good only for adults.
No, it's difficult. But there is a difference between difficult first intuitively, but with the possibility of developing later an intuition about it, or a story from the beginning, not as difficult but inconsistent a story, therefore there is no hope at all.
Yes.
So I'm saying there is hope. I'm saying it from experience. There is hope to be able to develop intuition about that kind of story, the Heisenberg story. There is no hope to develop intuition about the Schrödinger story. And I just don't use of my own experience. I tell you the experience of all great physicists that tried, that did not go to the area where people are only calculating and not worrying about it. When they really try to understand what it means, they could not. That's why Feynman says in his book, nobody will ever understand it. Why? Because he tried, tried, and couldn't understand it. He was very proud. Like, I don't understand it. After all this effort, no one will ever understand it. All right? I don't know if I told you that Einstein sent to Bohr and me a cable after we published the AB effect. He said, how beautiful. How come I ever thought about it myself? That was his cable. Okay, here's a fun story. Until tomorrow we'll discuss some more at the end of this story, but fun story. Suppose I tell you the following experiment. It's a redundant experiment, but I believe it could be done eventually. I have two crystals next to each other, and I see current going from the right crystal to the left crystal. Macroscopic current, okay?
So are they touching each other?
Huh?
Are they touching each other?
What's that?
The crystals touching each other?
Yeah, they're touching each other. Like transistor, for example. So there is a current flowing from each, from here to here. Now, I very carefully start to separate the crystals from each other slowly away, and I see that very quickly the current disappears. So I bring them very carefully apart, then I take one crystal and rotate it by 2 pi, very adiabatically. I rotate it by 2 pi, I know that I don't do anything to this crystal. If I did it very carefully, nothing changed there, then after 2 pi, it comes back to still. I bring it back again, and lo and behold, I find that the current is going in the opposite direction. I did not do anything, and still when I come back, the party goes in the opposite direction. So the question is, how can it happen? So this is something that I invented together with Leni Susskind when he was in Yeshiva in the 1960s and connected with super selection rules, as I will tell you if I have time in one, for maybe the last session. But I want to tell you how this is done. That's the fun thing. If I look at the current, the current is really like, it's exactly like the thing that we always discuss, the issue of double well. I can think of an electron being here as being in one well, the electron being here is being in the other well, and there is the current is simply a tunneling current. So this is a tunneling current of individual electrons that go from here to here and then back, so this is an oscillating current, in fact. Unless there is a potential difference. This is like in Josephson's dungeon, but there is a kind of two particles together, Cooper pair. But here, in transistor, there is a kind of individual electrons tiling each one from this side to that side. Now, suppose I separate this far away. So each individual electron, when I separate it, could be in a superposition of being here and here when I separate it, right? Suppose. Now, when it's a superposition of this and that, if I rotate this by 2 pi, because the electron is a fermion, when I rotate it by 2 pi, its wave function changes from plus to minus, changes by the sign. Although locally I can't tell you, because locally I measure only probabilities, which are psi to psi, but when I bring it back, and the electron now, the half electron here, and the half electron here now have a different relative phase than they had before. Because this being 1 plus I, it will be 1 minus I. And 1 minus I means that the current goes in the opposite direction. So this means that if you look at all the things that I told you about, the two cavities, the thing that decides whether the current going this way or that way is sigma y. Remember, there was sigma z that tells you the path is the left or the right. Sigma x was what energy, whether this plus that or this minus that. Sigma y is this plus I or this minus I. That is the thing that tells whether the current goes, maximum current goes this way or that way. The sigma y is the current operator. So when taking them far apart or taking them as 2 pi, I change not locally sigma y. Sigma y is the thing that tells you what is the relative phase between this and this. So this one, another beautiful No localizing of quantum mechanics. You do something that localizing means nothing, rotation by 2 pi. But if the particle in the fermion is in the superposition of being here and here, with 1 plus I, when I take it by 2 pi, it becomes 1 minus I. Then I bring it back together, and the current for all of them, for everyone, instead of going this way, we go this way. So this is a beautiful way of seeing the difference between classical and quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, there is a meaning to take one region of space rotated by 2 pi compared to the other, and then we see a geometrical effect if there are fermions that are in superposition in two different locations. Therefore, I think that one can understand supersymmetric space. And in supersymmetric space, you assume that the geometry of the space is on top of the usual geometry. You have to have flags at each point, which are like fermions, because you want to discuss the possibility of the space not being invariant under rotation by 2 pi. So now I say there is a reason for it, because if we assume that we take in space, we take a region of space and make a rotation by 2 pi and ask the geometry state, did anything change? If this would have been classically, if I measure a rotation of one region of space relative to the other by 2 pi, no change at all. But quantum mechanically, there can be a fermion shared here and here, then this rotation will make a change. So the geometry should also be able to reflect the change. Therefore, I say that quantum mechanics suggests that there is, we add to the usual geometry a flag, a fermion flag, that tells you whether how many times you rotated by 2 pi this region compared to the rest, because that is now a physical meaning. And that is connected with this new non-locality in quantum mechanics that says that if I have a fermion shared between one region and another region, I rotate this region by 2 pi, the strength of the fermion changes physically, so the geometry has to know also about relative rotation by 2 pi of one region compared to the other. And that suggests that we should augment g mu nu also by, in fact, you take the square root of the g mu nu, you get something like fermion. That is the true meaning of geometry if we want to consider also quantum effect.
But I thought that you were not in the superspace.
What?
Was that in the superspace? You were not in the superspace.
What?
Were you in the superspace?
Yeah, I'm saying there is, superspace has this property. Why? People found that if we write...
But in superspace, there is no difference between fermions and bosons, right?
Hmm?
In the superspace, if you have supersymmetry, there is no difference between
bosons
and fermions.
No, supersymmetry, you write geometry that knows about rotation by 2 pi, but then if you write the density operator that makes fermion and boson, then of course there is no difference. But if we look only at density, the means of fermion, of density that will form it. So, and you look at the non-local modular variable, you see there is a difference between fermion field and boson field. And it's this difference that I think is caused physically by enlarging the geometry. So the fun thing is not that, that's complicated mathematics. The fun thing is really, the fun thing, you can take a macroscopic crystal, separate it, or take 1 by 2 pi, bring it back, and lo and behold, you see a macroscopic current. Let's remember that you rotated this by 2 pi, although locally there was no difference at all. All the measurements you can do locally here will tell you the same answer if you rotated by 2 pi or not. Right? But you bring them together, and lo and behold,
this
is another beautiful non-locality of quantum mechanics.
Have people done this experiment?
What?
Have people done this experiment? Or
not yet. It hasn't done, right? But it should be done.
So maybe Yutaka should
do
it. Okay. Here's one. Here's the other. Do this experiment. Take it by 2 pi and show that the coffee will go the other way.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
Okay, let's see how
it is. On the 4 pi cases,
4 pi rotation, nothing will happen.
Nothing will happen.
Yeah, it's only the difference between even number and odd number of 2 pi.
That's correct, yeah. Next. So,
I saw a talk by Seth Lloyd a while ago where he gave a nice way to think about this issue. Seth Lloyd gave a nice visual way to think about this 4-pi rotation effect.
Who?
Seth Lloyd. You know Seth?
Oh, yeah.
The way that he described it is if you think of the electron as being its own object, then, you know, 2-pi rotation doesn't do anything. But if you think of it as being attached to the geometry, then the first rotation does this, and now my arm is twisted up, and this captures some change. And my second rotation does this.
Okay? Let's take a few more.
Thank you.